This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street across North Dakota. Is eating meat bad for the environment? Is that the right question to ask? Today we're going to revisit a subject we discussed before on Main Street, regenerative farming and ranching, a holistic style of food production that focuses on the health of the earth and the animals by following natural methods like open pasture grazing and crop rotation and diversification. First Fridays at B is a platform to engage and discuss important food topics. The monthly event is co-hosted by Food of the North and the Cass Clay Food Partners. September's First Friday discussion focused on regenerative grazing and the importance of developing and maintaining sustainable grassland ecosystems. You'll hear from Marshall Johnson from Audubon, Dakota, Kevin Sedovic from North Dakota State University, and Deanna and Cody Sand from Sand Ranch, producers of Prairie Soul Meats.
In many ways, prairie and grassland bird conservation for me, I came back to it in college. I studied business, not biology. And it was on kind of a whim trip with some friends we were in this 18x4 box or makeshift trailer looking out at prairie chickens. And it was then the landscape that always stirred my soul were the prairies and the grassland birds, the prairies, the songbirds. They're our troubadours, our songstresses of the sky. Something about that was latent in me for a long time. And I was reintroduced to it in that prairie chicken blind and have since dedicated my life to preserving grassland birds. Grassland birds are, for Audubon, the lens through which we view our work has always been birds, obviously. And grassland birds, there's nothing short of an environmental calamity happening with respect to grassland birds. They're declining more than any bird species in the world. Over the last 40 years alone, we've lost 53% of our grassland birds. And the reason is we're losing grasslands. We're losing pasture land, which was once our most ubiquitous native ecosystem here in North America. Obviously, that's a huge issue for anyone who cares about native environments and our broader ecosystem. And grassland birds, like most birds, are incredible indicators of overall environmental health. I was asked, are grassland birds a sort of prophet for the environment? My answer to that question was no. They're incredible prescient historians and journalists. They can't necessarily tell you what's going to happen, but you can believe them and take it to the bank when they are calling out with their silence, telling us what's happening today. And what's happening today is a collapse of our grassland bird populations. And what that means is a sort of cascading effect for pollinator species. Here in the Red River Valley, we've seen that kind of close up, a snapshot of what happens every day to our pollinators like monarch butterflies. And we are aware of that so many of our river systems now are designated as polluted and harmful. And that a big part of that is the loss of grasslands, which naturally take in water, store water, filtrate water. Grasslands also store carbon, billions of tons of carbon out of the atmosphere. When you take the amount of grasslands lost just between 2008 and 2014 here in the Northern Great Plains alone, it's the amount of 670 million cars emissions. So grasslands being our native ecosystem is really it's important that we protect grasslands for a whole variety of reasons. And for me and for Audubon, it's really simple. No cows, no grass, no birds. And that's why we sort of reached for the third rail, if you will, 5 years ago and came to the realization all of the things that we were doing in grassland conservation were meaningful, great, but they weren't fitting the bill. And one of the essence of what we've done through the Conservation Ranching Initiative is put the power in ranchers and put the power in you, people like you all, to make a difference with the one superpower that we all have, and it's our choice. And when you buy a product, when you spend a dollar, you are casting a vote for the environment and the world that you want to see. And so we wanted to create a certification program that set a high bar for ecosystem management. And you'll hear a lot about this technique and approach from Cody, Indiana, who are enrolled in the program and are an exemplary example of regenerative grazing. It really takes a set of practices that use cattle as a tool to regenerate and revitalize grasslands. And Peter was referencing a superstar. I'm going to turn it over to a superstar here, Dr. Kevin Sedovic with North Dakota State University. And he's going to share a little bit more about the science behind regenerative agriculture.
Well, thanks, Marshall. And I thank the organizers for inviting me to this workshop and this webinar. And it's an opportunity that you don't get a lot to do to visit with people that oftentimes we don't see. We do a lot of education for our ranchers and producers. And so this opportunity is, I do appreciate the time to be here and to be on this panel. It's a great panel to have today. You know, my goal today is to come up with one final outcome. And I'd like to see you all when I get done to understand that livestock grazing is good. Grazing is good. It's management or poor management that leads to bad decisions and leads to this negative effect that we see from the livestock side of it. And so the idea of regenerative agriculture, regenerative grazing, is a strategy that we can incorporate on our grasslands that really allows us to provide livestock in an open pasture setting, creates a beneficial impact in biology to these soils and plants and wildlife. And so the idea of grazing strategies that look at regenerative grazing is a tool we can use to not only produce beef on our grasslands, but also provide better habitat for many of our species. And Marshall talked about this value of our grasslands and for not only birds and pollinators and birds, we need to understand that we lose grasslands every year. The World Wildlife Federation has shown in the reports the last couple of years that about 5% of our grasslands is lost either to crop development or urban development. And this loss is an impact that affects not only the birds and the bees and the butterflies, but it affects our carbon cycle and affects our nutrient flow that occurs across our planet. And so grazing is a value. Livestock grazing provides value to these grasslands that creates not only an income for producers, but also keeps that grass in grasslands for the birds and for the bees and for the butterflies. And so it becomes important to understand that. But it also becomes important to understand that grazing is good. And when I say grazing is good, if we do not graze grasslands, they actually lose vigor. They lose the production potential that we can see from those grasslands that create a diverse landscape. No grazing actually leads to dominance of one to two species. No matter where you're at in North Dakota, where you're at in Minnesota, where you're at in the country, lack of grazing will enhance certain plant species, and we lose diversity. Diversity is critical for expanding our pollinators and our birds. So we want to see a diverse landscape across there. And regenerative grazing is a tool we can use today to enhance that diversity across the landscape. And what grazing really is a disturbance. It's a disturbance that's allowed to create this plant community that can shift and change and create heterogeneity across the landscape. So in simplicities, you know, I talk about opportunities for regenerative grazing. And probably the most common practice we see today is just rotational grazing using multiple pastures that allows producers to put cattle into one pasture. You basically create a stock density impact on that grasslands, and you get rest on the pastures in front. You then move those cattle out of that, or sheep or whatever you're grazing, out of that cell, and it creates recovery. When you graze a grass, it's like you're taking away carbon from the surface, so those plants have to respond. And you get an imbalance of carbon to nitrogen across that landscape, and it has to produce more carbon when you consume it. This creates your roots are really actively growing. They get this interaction with the microbial population, and you create new shoots or new carbon. the healthier the plant community, the more carbon is produced and more carbon is consumed or sequestered. So it's important to realize in the end that a healthy grasslands creates a healthy system that functions. We talk about global warming, or we talk about greenhouse effects or methane. A healthy grass community can consume almost as much methane as it produces just through the conversion of methane to carbon dioxide and the consumption. So if we lead the day, it's looking at livestock grazing as a tool. It's a way to keep grasslands in grasslands. It's a way to provide a protein source for food source for human consumption. And it's also a way to cycle these nutrients that you'll see from the air to the ground and create this diverse landscape across there. So hopefully when we get done today that you understand where I'm coming from on livestock grazing is good and that we can really go from there on the production side. And so me, I want to turn it over to Deanna Sand to talk about, as a livestock producer, how they use these operations or how these strategies in terms of regenerative ags.
Thanks, Kevin. So we're a third generation ranch, and within the next year, we're hoping to be a fourth generation ranch as our daughter and her boyfriend are moving back home. So how we ranch and what we do isn't really simply defined. Cody and I have ranched here for about 20 years. My parents and grandparents farmed and ranched on this same property. And in 2011, after we were having some financial struggles, we learned about holistic management and we changed the way that we manage our land. We went from a conventional model to a holistic model. When we were more conventional, we calved our cows out in March and April. We fed them all winter long. We put up hay all summer. When we changed to holistic, what that meant was we really focused on the natural systems and working with nature. We stopped relying on outside inputs and assistance from outside decision makers. We say we fired they, meaning we had to observe and not rely on the feed salesman, the vet, the banker to tell us what to do and when to do it. And it was super scary, but really freeing in the long run. In working with nature, we now calve our cows in June when the deer are having their babies. This was the single best change of quality of life for ourselves and for our cattle. The calves are born when the weather is warm, they're born out on grass. And by doing that, we've eliminated our need for antibiotics. We just don't get sick livestock anymore, just working with nature. And we also are less stressed. We don't need to be out there all winter long checking everything. They need a lot less assistance. So at the same time, when we changed to holistic management, we also began a more intensive grazing management, the more regenerative grazing. We have amazing intact native grasslands on our ranch, which just means they've never been plowed under. Native grasslands are super diverse. They have different root systems. They have a lot of different plants to them. They're super valuable because they just don't have a need to be replanted. And with our cattle grazing holistically or regeneratively, we actually even increase our plant species. We also have tame grass on our land, which is old farm ground that's been reestablished into grass. The primary change we made when we started changing our grazing was to increase the number of cattle in a single group and move them more often. We sectioned our ranch off to make 65 permanent pastures. So by doing this, we're doing what we can to mimic the way the vast herds of bison used to graze in this area. We graze an area or a pasture and then move the cattle onto the next paddock. So in utilizing this type of grazing, the majority of paddocks or pastures on our ranch are resting. Those paddocks have plants that are growing stems and leaves. They're pulling carbon out of the air. They're growing roots to help increase our rainfall infiltration. And after cattle are moved out of a paddock, we want those plants to rest and recover and really express themselves. So as they're regrowing, they're providing a canopy over the soil. They're keeping it cooler, which helps the soil biology and all over soil health. So this also offers protective cover for nesting birds and food for other wildlife when our cattle aren't in there. Some areas on our ranch get up to an entire year of rest and recovery. So when our cattle are grazing, they're really an important part of the ecosystem. They're adding natural fertilizer, dung and urine. Their hooves are impacting the soil, leaving little areas where water can pool, even opening soil in places that might have been crusted over. When cattle bite a plant, there's also a symbiotic relationship that tells the plant to add roots and regrow. So, and as cattle walk, they're grazing and trampling some plants. So this becomes organic matter on the surface of the soil, and it'll eventually break down and build even more soil. And it also provides an armor over the top to prevent evaporation. So after 10 years or so of grazing management this way, we have healthy, resilient soil, healthy plants, and we use no chemicals on our land or our cattle. Nature's pretty amazing if we can just get out of the way. And as my friend told me about how we ranch, he said there's more to learn from the process of nature than the process of man, which I found really interesting. So all our management had provided healthy livestock, but we were still selling our cattle at a local sale barn. From there, we knew the next stop was a feedlot, and that didn't really align with what we were doing on our ranch. So we began direct marketing our home-raised, grass-fed, grass-finished beef. We named our business Prairie Soul Meats by Sand Ranch, and the name was inspired by a quote I heard. I'm not sure who to credit, but it says, anyone can love the mountains, but it takes a soul to love the prairies. And I have always loved the prairies. I grew up walking on these prairies with my grandma, and they're definitely in my soul. So selling our beef, we've learned a lot about our food system. We have a passion to provide healthy, delicious, nutritious beef to as many people as we can. And we're honored when someone who wasn't able to eat beef any longer can eat our beef with no ill effects. We absolutely love that our ranch can now be full circle and support the grassland ecosystem. Our cattle are a huge part of that. And as another friend says, they have a really great life and one bad day. So since changing our management to a more regenerative system, we naturally have a thriving ecosystem. It's all because of our management, but it was already there. We've worked with several groups and organizations and agencies. It's not something we ever thought that we would be doing when we were just conventionally ranching. As Cody so eloquently always says, we didn't give two shits about a duck or a bird when we were going broke. So a byproduct of our holistic management is just conservation of natural resources. Our management aligns with what conservation groups are looking for and want to promote and protect. We've been lucky enough to host tours for local, regional, and national groups. Cody and I are both mentors for and part of the North Dakota Grazing Lands Coalition. We've said yes to studies on our ranch. There's currently a NDSU is doing a pollinator study. Blue Dasher Farms is studying dung beetles and vegetation. We have local FFA range judging kids coming next week to practice identifying native grassland plants. We've been approached about a possible carbon study, which would be really fun. Some other groups we've gotten to work with include National Wildlife Federation, Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, North Dakota Natural Resource Trust, and of course, Audubon. And we're always happy to share our ranch and show folks a grassland ecosystem that's intact and alive with pollinators and diversity, wildlife, birds, insects. And the reason all of that exists together is not in spite of the cattle, but really because of them and the way that they're managed. It really just all works together.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. You're listening to a discussion from First Fridays at B about regenerative farming and ranching. And after that discussion, the panelists took questions from the audience.
There's a lot of people that think that there really isn't a place for animal agriculture and that the cattle are inherently bad. We know that there are challenges in changing that public perception, but how do we move beyond that?
I worked for an organization that for years we trumpeted that same notion that maybe livestock management was hurting the ecosystem. But I think science and time, you know, has allowed us to understand that nuance, that it's not the cow, it's the how. And I think that's important for folks to keep in mind.
This question comes from Hannah Olson to Deanna and Cody. What was the final straw that drove your ranch to implement the holistic and regenerative changes you did?
The one story that always comes up. We had a financial meeting at the end of 1 year, and we had a huge amount of carryover bills. And we sat with our financial analysts, and what he said was, you need to borrow more money next year. I was working at the place, driving an hour back and forth from work. He was building saddles. We only had the cattle that we had, and borrowing more money wasn't going to get us anywhere. And then we happened to just hear about a holistic management class, and And for us, I mean, that was the catalyst we needed. It's like, we can't keep borrowing more money when we're not making any more to pay that back. You know, obviously that doesn't work for anybody. So for us, the holistic management was just, when we took the class, it was just like, oh my gosh, I didn't know we could cabin this summer. I didn't know we didn't have to do this and that. And so we, I'm married to somebody who's very all or nothing. So we were all in on the holistic management instantly.
What were the biggest challenges you faced in switching to regenerative grazing? And I'll also add, was this something where one year you were conventional and then the next year you were regenerative grazing, or was it a multi-year process?
Well, it's been a multi-year process looking back, but we pretty much switched everything as quickly as we could. One of the biggest challenges was there's support out there, but they're far and few between. Like, the ranches that do what we do are 6 hours away and 8 hours away, and our neighbors don't do what we do. So you just can't call somebody and ask if you have a problem, and you do run into problems, especially when it's new territory. So probably one of the most difficult things in holistic management is when Deanna said we fired they, we can't call our veterinarian or a feed specialist. We don't even have those people anymore, but they do not make decisions on our ranch anymore. We have to observe and see in our management what we did or did not do to make this thing work or not work.
And sometimes you don't know what you messed up or did right till a year later, and you have to kind of backtrack and look at that. You know, nature doesn't turn on a dime. So sometimes if you run into an issue, you have to look back at what you did to cause that, because most of it is what we caused or did.
It's always our fault, 100% of the time.
So you guys do the certified bird friendly program through Audubon, and Clara asks, I guess this question is for Marshall, what are the requirements for becoming having that bird friendly certification?
Yeah, absolutely. When we started the program, we were advised by a lot of different people. And this is sort of, as I alluded to earlier, the third rail of conservation, to put the Audubon name on packages of beef. Can you imagine the resistance we met? But again, when we just led with science, and we thought early on, well, this might be the best way to go about this would be a organic certification. And it's about nuance. I've been on some ranches that are organic, and they're some of the worst places for birds. So when we look at what birds need, we were also advised, well, let's just focus on the height of grass. Well, that's not necessarily the right approach either, because birds feed on other critters like insects. And if we're not protecting the insect populations and the pollinator populations, then what are birds going to eat? And so we created a framework which focuses on habitat management, forage and feeding, environmental stewardship, and then animal welfare, because we felt like all of those things were important to the enhancement of the ecosystem. And so the Audubon certification, some of the things that are prohibited are use of neonicotinoid pesticides. We know how harmful those are to our pollinator species. No confined feeding. So this is a pasture-raised, grass-fed program. The protocols, the heart and soul of the protocols, are our habitat management plans. And those are living documents that incorporate those four areas: environmental stewardship, habitat management, animal welfare, and forage and feeding into them.
You've been listening to a First Fridays at Bee discussion about regenerative agriculture. We'll have more of the discussion with the panelists after the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Amtrak will cut service beginning October 19th for its long-distance routes nationwide to 3 times a week instead of the current daily service. That's because ridership has dropped during the coronavirus pandemic. These routes include the Empire Builder that serves Fargo and many other cities in North Dakota and Minnesota along its line from Seattle to Chicago. Barry Green represents North Dakota, Minnesota, and Montana for the Rail Passengers Association, which lobbies on behalf of long-distance passenger service. He says not only does the reduction in service cause an inconvenience for those that use the Empire Builder, it will also mean an economic hit to those communities it serves.
When Amtrak goes to this tri-weekly service, communities along the Builder route will lose almost $300 million in economic benefits over the next 9 months. That just comes from people traveling to locations, taking taxis or Ubers, eating in local restaurants, staying in hotels, tourist activity.
Green says a $5 billion bailout bill that would retain daily Amtrak service has passed the House but has not been taken up in the Senate. He's urging those having an interest in seeing continued service to contact their congressional delegation to support the funding. Beginning today, farmers and ranchers will be able to apply for another round of the USDA's Coronavirus Food Assistance Program. Up to $14 billion is available for producers who continue to face market disruptions and increased costs due to COVID-19. Here's North Dakota's Farmers Union President Mark Watney. He says it's timely.
We're coming into a harvest that much of our state had some relatively good production. We did have some tough areas, but we're selling into a marketplace that is just totally below the cost of production. So with the trade war and the pandemic going on, without this additional help, farmers just don't cash flow.
Watney says he's been hearing some disturbing news about farm loan delinquencies. He says this will help. He also says he understands this round will include more crops than livestock. Producers will be able to apply at their local farm service agency county office. And with some North Dakota schools operating in a hybrid situation, a mix of in-person and online courses, some families are looking at their options for safe and quality child care. North Dakota has about 1,600 licensed and self-declared child care providers who serve children through age 12. The State Human Services Department put in some modified operating practices in place for safety, including limiting group size and screening protocols. Carmen Treholt is the statewide manager for early childhood services.
It does put a strain on our ability to follow our licensing capacity because of that group size. But at this point, I feel that the child care programs in North Dakota have done a really good job of networking. And if there's a spot available somewhere else, if they can't fit a family in, they will help families find child care.
Treholt says she's heard from a number of parents around the state who are happy with the safety measures put in place at child care facilities. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Regenerative farming and ranching is described as an approach to food production that places a high priority on the health of land and animals by following natural methods. The September meeting of First Fridays at B featured a presentation about regenerative grazing. Here is more of the discussion that followed.
So I was particularly struck by some of the comments around carbon sequestration of grasslands. Do you get the same carbon sequestration benefits of just grassland that is untouched, or is there an advantage of having those animals grazing that land?
Well, the big important thing is that you have to have grasses or plants growing. And so the longer they're growing into the season, the more carbon they're going to sequester. So if you look at a plant, the main goal of every plant is to produce a seed head. That occurs sometime in usually July or August. And then at that point, it reduces its uptake and it goes through a different process in terms of seed development. If with grazing strategies, if you can keep the grasses grazed in recovery, so you got regrowth, you got elongation, that plant is constantly taking up carbon. That plant is constantly exuding into the soil health component. So the really goal of this, and that's true of even on cropland, if you can keep living tissue on cropland longer, keep your grasses growing longer, they will sequester carbon longer through the season. So a healthy plant, healthy growing plant, will always consume and sequester more carbon than a plant that's not. And grazing is a tool you can do to enhance that growth.
And you called that a disturbance. I saw that there was a question also on here about using fires and burning. That's another management tool that folks use to create those disturbances?
Yeah, absolutely. Burning is another tool that is becoming more and more popular throughout the United States. And we see more and more of it coming up in the Northern Plains. It's a tool you can use to keep that vegetation. You get a disturbance, so plants respond. More flowering plants actually respond following a disturbance. So it really enhances the pollinator population as a whole, and that disturbance with grazing can create this more longer term impact on the plant. But the trick is you still have to have recovery. These plants have to be able to recover and stay healthy. And so that's where the rotation or the regenerative grazing is very beneficial. Whether you have burn or not, the combination creates this impact or disturbance. On cropland, we try to not disturb. With grasslands, we want disturbance, but you got to have recovery so those plants can actually stay healthy.
This is a question for all. Is consumer education of regenerative grazing the most challenging component of your work? If not, can you expand?
Yeah, it's been a challenge, I guess, to say the least. It just hasn't been around a lot, and it's something that I think has just got lost through society over the last 100 years, and you just wake up one day and everything's different. What we do now is what happened for probably millennia, and we're catching up, I guess, but it's not mainstream anymore. So everything you read, hear, been taught, is just very unconventional, I guess. So we find that actually more people in bigger urban areas, it makes sense to them quicker, or they already know about it. In the rural part though, it's a lot tougher where we live. And I don't know why that is. It's just tradition, and people don't like to change. It's hard for them. It's fearful, and they don't want to go away from the normal.
You know, I do think, you know, Sam's hit it right. It's change. It's the idea of change, and change can be scary. You know, it's our job to promote these ideas and show why. What I try to do is show the economic value. I mean, like the Sands, you have to be able to make a living in the livestock industry. And so if we can show the benefits of regenerative grazing and the return in terms on your investment and time, it's easier. And to have a ranch at the Sand Ranch that I can demonstrate and show, producers will change other producers. Me and Marshall, we're supposed to be experts, but we don't get the big change. It's the Sands that will create the change.
And so, Marshall, you kind of use the lens of birds and folks that really care about birds and those habitats for them. Do you find that that's a powerful tool for change, communicating with folks to get more interested in regenerative grazing and supporting farmers or ranchers like the Sands?
Yeah, that's absolutely the tool that we use. It's the tool or the approach that is most natural for us. Because that's what we've done since our creation more than 117 years ago. And what we're seeing is our members are responding to that. It goes against the grain a bit of what they've traditionally heard about livestock management and the use of livestock. And I get asked all the time, you know, shouldn't we convert or move more to a plant-based diet or replace traditional meats with plant-based meats? And yeah, I'm never here to tell someone who has their reasons for being vegan or vegetarian, you know, they've got to change. But if you're asking from the standpoint of the environment, the best thing we can do for the environment is to produce better food across the board. And in this part of the world, native prairie is what's supposed to be there. And the native prairie that we've got left are grazed by animals and grazed by ranchers. And we should be supporting people like Cody and Deanna and their management. They've done the hard work of stepping up and changing their management. Are we going to use our superpower, our choice, to help incentivize and buoy their efforts? So we use birds to tell that story, and we have a peer review process for evaluating bird populations on each ranch. And the flat out truth is birds have a better time on Audubon bird friendly land than other places. We know that now. And so I would certainly encourage people to do their research and support ranches like the Sand Ranch.
So, and even on our ranch, when we changed over our grazing, we quadrupled the amount of grass we were growing by moving our cattle and managing differently. So it's economic, it's everything. I mean, the way that the cattle change the landscape is huge without doing anything other than changing a little bit of fencing and things, but it was a big economic change for us.
So meaning financially, on our side, when we did the work and made the hard changes, everybody knows land prices are very expensive at this time in our history, I guess. So if we want to expand, we don't have to go compete against our neighbors to buy land or rent land, because essentially we bought another three ranches just by changing our management, but we didn't have to actually expand our acreage, which is pretty cool.
From a health biodiversity perspective, do we need to think about converting more land back into grassland, or is it more advantageous to think about those management practices and getting more folks to be managing that land differently, like the Sands are managing their land? Or is it a combination of both?
I mean, I'd love to see a combination of both. I think, you know, management is really the most important tool that you can do today, whether it's on crop ground or on grasslands. You can do even a better job with livestock on crop ground to enhance the biology. If I can convert crop ground back to grass, then I'm happy. That's a great practice. I'll go for it all day. It comes down to economics, though. Economics will drive that, and policies drive that. And so, you know, between the combination of the two, whatever we're doing, I think livestock play a role in that, whether it's crop or pasture land. And I think it's just management that will drive the success.
Marshall, Steve wants to know, how do you determine an increase or decrease in bird numbers and species?
Yeah, absolutely. We use the Bird Conservancy of the Rockies IMBCR protocol, and it's considered the Cadillac of grassland bird abundance and density monitoring. So each ranch enrolled in our program, we use that protocol in that process to monitor the birds there. We then went a step further and created what we call the Bird Friendliness Index, which is a proprietary tool of Audubon that takes the ranch that we're monitoring and compares it with nearby ranches. And so then we can really drill down to see if our approach is having a greater or deleterious effect on bird populations there. And most of our ranches are trending in the right direction, are already there.
We always like to conclude every first Friday with a final question for all of our panelists. And that is, what can the folks who are listening here today do to support you, to share this message, to get more people supporting Audubon's program and regenerative grazing practices?
The number one thing that you can do to support Audubon is to support ranches like the Sand Ranch and Prairie Soul Meats.
You know, for me, it's the way I started, you know, just understand the value of the livestock grazer that it has on our resources. And so understand grazing isn't bad. It's management that's bad. And so having examples like the Sand Ranch and producers who are doing the right thing in conservation planning to enhance our resources.
Just getting the word out there about, you know, what we do and how it can hopefully economically impact other people too. Obviously, if you want to buy our beef, that would be great. For us, it's a whole bigger system than that. It's just keeping everything happy, keeping quality of life, good cattle, good food, good plants, you know, it's the whole circle.
You've been listening to a discussion about regenerative farming and ranching that took place during the September First Fridays at B. The event featured Kevin Zedovic from North Dakota State University, Marshall Johnson from Ottoman, Dakota, and Deanna and Cody Sand from Sand Ranch. They produce Prairie Soul Meats. First Fridays at B is a monthly public meeting about healthy food systems, co-hosted by the Food of the North and the Cass Clay Food Partners. Next month's Zoom discussion will be about food insecurity. You can find details about it at foodofthenorth.com. Next on Main Street, Bill Thomas with a poetry project for senior citizens.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
And by Benedictine Living Community of Wahpeton, where health, independence, and choice come to life through skilled nursing care, short-stay rehabilitation, assisted living, basic care, and home care. A member of the Benedictine Health System, blcwahpeton.org.
Hi, this is Bill Thomas at Prairie Public. When the pandemic descended on us, a lot of people wondered, rightly, about being able to continue. You can imagine that this would especially apply to a project for older people, since they have repeatedly been identified as very vulnerable. But at the Burleigh County Senior Center, they used an Arts for Life grant from the North Dakota Council on the Arts to do a poetry project based on a sort of template, Where I'm From. Lisa Bennett works at the Burleigh County Senior Centers, where she did this project, and she reads from a poem produced in spite of the pandemic.
I am from dust, by Norma Nichols. I am from dust, from sealer and comet. I am from the brown-painted house in the heart of town, which we fixed up every year. I am from the sunflower and from the apple tree and from the dried apples we took from it. I am from ham on Easter and from the honest and trustworthy. I am from Edward and Bee. I'm from baking oatmeal rolls that would melt in your mouth and carpentry, and from being on time. I'm from swimming a half hour after lunch, and I'm from the music by the Moody Blues. I'm from a long line of doers. I'm from New York in the Catskill Mountains and Irish ancestry, from steak and potatoes, from going on vacation in the rain and going home with heavy tents. Mom didn't want to sleep in water. Quilts held high and pictures taken, and an old hairpiece hanging on the wall, a few hundred years old, looking like flowers made of the family hair. April 2020.
Kind of makes you want to do one of these yourself, doesn't it? Here is Alicia Underlee Nelson, who wrote about this project.
The poems inspired by the elders of the Burleigh County Senior Center leap off the page and go straight to your senses. The heady scent of lilacs mingles with fresh bread from a summer kitchen. Fibber McGee and Molly plays on the radio as grandmother's clock keeps time. The quiet moments that make up a life can be just as evocative as the major milestones. The lives of 14 individuals are rendered in a series of sensory snapshots that put the reader right in the subject's shoes. The truth of these poems is nestled in dozens of tiny details that history often overlooks. It's in the bark of the gnarled oak tree digging into the back of your knees as you hang upside down from its branches. The crinkle of a brown paper bag of Christmas treats. The tart taste of bullberry jelly on your tongue. The elders served by Bismarck's Burleigh County Senior Center live in their own residences and come to the center for classes, activities, and meals. Social distancing measures that curb the spread of the coronavirus have made community building a challenge. So site manager Lisa Bennett felt that the poetry project, which could be conducted remotely, was a responsible and timely way to use the facility's Art for Life grant from North Dakota Council on the Arts, and to process the feelings stirred up by a global health crisis.
I think every one of the people that did this poem, Where I'm From, will say that it gave them time to think about what's important in life. And I participated as well. Most of the people grew up in the Depression or shortly thereafter, so they know what it's like to give up things. It was a very good reminder at a perfect time when we're all homebound, basically. I'm from Shared Bathtub Water, John Maddock. I am from the Sears and Roebuck catalog. From Lifebuoy soap and Watkins vanilla. I am from a two-story farmhouse with a summer kitchen, a kerosene cook stove filling the air with mom's fresh bread. I am from a vegetable garden below the barn, the lilac bush blossoming for Memorial Day, mom's love for flowers, geraniums, irises, surrounded by a wire fence. I'm from midnight masses and a father with patience and tolerance, from Jack Pat, Jack Matt, and Stinky. I'm from 4-H and angel food cake for birthdays, and from driving our toy trucks on the veins of Dad's arms as he read the newspaper. I'm from Don't Lick the Frost from the Steel Fence Post, and Who Threw the Overalls in Mrs. Murphy's Chowder? I'm from visiting graves with relatives on a Sunday. I'm from Grand Forks, North Dakota, an Irish father and French mother. apple pies, and Good Friday oyster stew. From being saved by an older sister after falling through the ice on a stock pond, she found a post and hung on to it. The leather Davenport, where I would rest and take comfort in the picture of a young girl watching a robin in the trees. Mom's red garden cart tucked away in our garden shed. April 2020.
The subjects telephoned writers Matthew Musakia and Maureen McDonald-Hins, who asked them a series of questions about their memories. After the discussion, the writers shaped their responses using the Where I'm From poetic template developed by George Ella Lyons. The finished poems were shared with the seniors, who were encouraged to send copies to friends and family, and published in the community newsletter. The poems will soon be compiled into a book for the elders as well. Some of the subjects admittedly needed a little convincing at first. I thought, oh dear, my life is not exciting, laughs Nance Skerritt, describing her initial reaction to the interview with McDonald-Hins. But I found a lot of things to write about. I hadn't thought about some of this stuff for years. It was really fun for them, says McDonald-Hins. Once they started sharing the poem with friends and family, I knew it was going to bring up even more memories and discussions.
That's the value of this program. And this poem,
Bennett says,
is after reading about air raid sirens and ration cards, living on WPA wages, or a struggling farm profit, and the tales of surviving icy ponds and exploding stoves and harsh winters, and most of them without reliable heat or indoor plumbing, I've gained a whole new appreciation for the people I serve here at Burley County Senior Center. It taught me that they all lived really full lives, and it also proves to me that the human race is very resilient. This was just a wonderful project, and I hope that we'll do it again in the near future.
Irene Walter, a poet herself, used the poem written about her to inspire her own work. She says anyone can and should do a project like this with people they love. You just have to go back and think about how things were, she advises. I wish that we had asked our grandparents more because there's so many things we wonder about now. Talk to the older ones while they're still here. This is Alicia Underly Nelson for Prairie Public.
I'm from an Irish clogger and Dixieland funerals by Nancy Keating. I am from the television, from spices and potatoes. I am from a very big house with big windows and nice trees. Very peaceful, with a lot of sunlight coming in. I am from lilacs, spirea, and wild roses. The Souris, Mouse River. Our house, an island with four bridges all around. I'm from midnight mass, and nobody ever saying goodbye. From Philadelphia, June, Phyllis Ione, and Clancy, and Junebug. I'm from smoking, unfortunately, and dancing lessons, and from everyone learning to play an instrument. I'm from Look It Up and Benny Goodman's Sing, Sing, Sing. I'm from beautiful Sunday dinners of meat and potatoes. I'm from Minot, North Dakota, and Swedish, Irish, German, English, Eggs Benedict and Yorkshire pudding. From a grandfather, the first sheriff of Renville County, grandma campaigning against him to stop him from keeping the job, his sheriff's badge of nickel, and my mom's wedding rings kept in my living room right here. April 2020.
That was Lisa Bennett from the Burley County Senior Center reading one of the poems worked up as part of their Arts for Life project from the North Dakota Council on the Arts. That was Alicia Underly Nelson before reporting on it. You can see lots more about this and other projects at arts.nd.gov.
When you hear arts programming on Prairie Public, know that it's supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 21st. The ski industry in North Dakota has experienced many ups and downs. Currently, there are three ski areas in the state, Huff Hills near Mandan, Botnose Winter Park, and Frostfire near Walhalla. In the 1970s, there were four other ski areas, Rolla View in Rolla, Skyline in Devil's Lake, Grand Forks Villa Vista, and Minot's Trestle Valley. Today's datebook tells the Trestle Valley story. Two men from Minot believed the nearby hills would be suitable for skiing. Dudley Zimmerman, a local businessman, and Gary Leslie, Minot State University's gymnastics coach, were the driving forces. In 1974, they formed a corporation to build the new ski resort. From an airplane, Dudley Zimmerman scouted the hills near Donnybrook and Sawyer, and then the Trestle Valley Hills near the railway bridge at Gassman Coulee, west of Minot. Trestle Valley's hills had 200 feet of elevation. Leasing land from Jim Shaw, the corporation built a lodge with a big fireplace. They bought skis for the rental shop, snowmaking machines, and ski lifts, a T-bar, a Poma lift, and rope tows. Trestle Valley Ski Area featured a bunny hill for beginners and 11 ski runs with cool names like Sunnyside, Cat's Meow, Red Baron, and Hot Dog. Thus began a decade of winter fun. However, it was a costly venture. Aside from the initial construction, there were electrical bills and payroll. Weather, however, was the biggest problem. In 1978, a warm front melted all the snow within a week, draining the investors' financial resources. As Gary Leslie said, it was like watching thousands of dollars melt and run down the hill. The business floundered due to unseasonably warm winters. And on this date in 1986, newspaperman Gary Gilmore wrote about the high cost of operating North Dakota ski resorts and lamenting that Trestle Valley had closed in 1983. Trestle Valley, 5 miles west of Minot, was an expensive disappointment. But for the people who learned skiing as a lifetime sport, the joys of schussing down the slopes, carving out turns, and making cold weather memories, it was absolutely worth it. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck and Karen Johnson. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As you know, as we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show at prairiepublic.org. Tuesday on Main Street, 6 Grand Forks school buildings have been listed in the National Register of Historic Places. That's the federal government's list of properties it considers worthy of preservation and recognition. The schools embody a period of American history marked by a sharp population increase and post-World War II prosperity. We'll talk about the designations with historic preservation specialist Zachary J. Lechner. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.